This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's kind of funny, don't you think, how something so quantifiable can come down to something so mushy. This economy is measured a million different ways, but mention something amorphous like consumer confidence, and all bets are off. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions, Constellation.com. And by LendingTree, where you can choose up to four customized loan offers, 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 25th of March today, Tuesday. Great to have you here. And how are you feeling? We ask because we care. And we care because the way you're feeling right now might have more to do with what happens in this economy than anything Wall Street's going to do. We've given you this statistic before. About 70% of the economy is driven by consumer spending. Unhappy consumers tend not to spend. So it was a big deal when the Conference Board released its most recent gauge of consumer confidence this morning. Lousy is the one-word headline, the lowest in 5 years. We wanted to get a more tangible feel for things, though, so we sent Jeremy Hobson out onto the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to ask around a little bit.
I have a reasonable level of confidence, but I'm not overwhelmingly positive in my outlook. I'm very frugal anyway.
So you're always acting as a slightly underconfident consumer?
Yes.
How confident are you right now as a consumer?
Not at all. You know, things are really tight, you know, gas is high, so I'm not confident at all. Food, everything is high.
My name is Chris. I'm from Seattle.
Do you ever wake up in the last few months with sort of all the rockiness in the economy and have a sinking feeling?
Sure I do. I think twice about whether or not I should be going to Nordstrom's and, you know, buying things that are not on sale or things that I don't absolutely need.
How confident are you as a consumer right now?
It's getting tougher.
What kind of changes are you making in your personal life as a result of what's going on around you in the economy?
I'm not going to feed my kids anymore, so I have to get gas.
You're going to stop feeding your children?
Yes, they don't need to eat that much.
I hope that they're not too upset when they find out about that plan.
I haven't told them yet.
Kidding aside, we hope, here's part of the reason consumers aren't all that happy. The most valuable assets most of us have are worth less and less every day. The slide in real estate was punctuated today by the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index. It's a snapshot of housing prices in major markets, and it is an ugly picture indeed. Prices were down more than 11% in January from a year earlier. That is the steepest drop in the history of the index, which goes back to 1987. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
We're not on a roller coaster ride with these housing prices. It's more like a plunge.
The speed of the fall suggests to me that people are dumping houses.
Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says housing prices are falling faster than expected. That could mean bargain basement prices for, well, basements. Weiss says we had a big party when housing prices were soaring. The housing bubble was biggest in California, Nevada, and Florida. Now it's popped, leaving plenty of headaches behind.
Basically, the ones who had the best time are the ones who are having the biggest hangovers, but it's hurting all of us.
S&P's index covers 20 high-priced urban areas. Michelle Meyer is an economist at Lehman Brothers. She says prices are lower even in parts of the country where there wasn't a bubble. Homeowner confidence is eroding. Buyers are staying away. Meyer says one culprit is the bad housing news on the front page almost every day.
The biggest housing depression, recession since the Great Depression.
The government agrees with S&P. A federal housing index released today shows prices were down 3% from last year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right. So knowing all that, that consumer confidence is down and home prices are still sliding, maybe it's time for some counterintuitive consumer behavior, like thinking about getting into the housing market. Dan McGinn writes on real estate for Newsweek magazine. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you roll these reports from the past couple of days into one big ball of wax. What does it mean if you're sitting there observing the housing market thinking about buying?
Well, the fact that transactions are up but prices are down is actually a good thing. The reason we saw the numbers we've seen the last couple of days is that people who've had a for sale sign in front of their house are seeing the stock market going wildly up and down, the consensus now that we're in a recession, and the notion that this housing market is not going to turn around very soon. So I think the numbers that we saw yesterday and today represent people throwing in the towel and saying, you know, if I want to sell my house, I have to be more realistic about what it's worth.
I don't want to put the pressure on you right out of the gate, but is this now officially a buyer's market? I mean, can we pick and choose out there?
Oh, I think it's been a buyer's market for quite some time. Inventories are great. Mortgage rates are below 6%. If you don't have to sell a house, this is a good time to buy one. The problem is many of us, if we want to buy a new house, we have to sell our old one, and that's not so easy.
The other thing we have to do is get a mortgage, and we've been hearing so much about this credit squeeze and liquidity crisis. Can I go out now, assuming I've got average to decent credit, and get myself a mortgage for a 30-year loan?
Well, you need three things. You need at least average credit scores these days. You need to have a down payment, something you didn't need to have a few years ago, and you also have to have a good job with the ability to actually prove that you make some money. No more no documentation loans for you.
I want to run a word by you and see what your take is. What would you think if I said bottom of the market?
I'd say you're a very optimistic guy.
Well, put a number on it. Put a time span on it.
Even the National Association of Realtors economists yesterday, who was crowing over these good numbers, said maybe in the second half of the year we'll start to see things firm up. Optimists would say late 2008. I would probably say 2009.
So if I'm a buyer, should I just hang around for a little while?
It depends what your mentality is. There are some people who are afraid of the notion of buying a house and watching the value go down even a little bit more. You have to put it in perspective. If you buy a house today, depending on where you live, you're probably paying 10%, maybe even more, less than you would have 2 years ago. That's not a bad deal. Might it go down a little bit more? Sure, but you know, you're probably going to own it for 5-7 years. I don't think it's a bad time to buy.
Yeah, but continuing that train of thought, though, depending on where you live and where you buy, it might have another 20-30% to fall.
The most extreme views on the housing market is that we're going to see 30-40% declines, but that is somewhat of an extreme view. Probably the median prediction would be 15% declines, which means we're probably two-thirds of the way there. I mean, I think prices will go lower. I just think they've gone down far enough that if I was having a child or needed a bigger house and I didn't have to sell my own house, I would be thinking about it right now.
Dan McGinn covers real estate for Newsweek magazine. His book is called House Lust. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Analysts at Goldman Sachs said today there is still plenty of squeeze left in the credit squeeze. They figure total losses worldwide now are going to hit $1.2 trillion. Wall Street's going to account for about a third of that. The Federal Reserve's been doing what it can to help, besides bailing out Bear Stearns, I mean. One of the ways Bernanke and company have been trying to prop things up is by literally putting more money into the market. Not with printing presses, but by short-term auctions to keep the lending pump primed. Commercial banks can bid for month-long loans from the central bank at pretty good interest rates. Today, the Fed announced the results of its latest auction, the 8th. A total of $260 billion has been injected since December. Now, what happens to all that money? Well, we're glad you asked. Here's John Dimsdale from Washington.
On the block this time was $50 billion, which banks will borrow at a low 2.6% interest rate for 28 days. The auctions are designed to provide banks with reserves used to cover everyday operations, such as cash withdrawals from checking and savings deposits, as well as individual or corporate loans. Since the auction money must be returned to the Fed in 4 weeks, it's generally not used to backstop long-term borrowing like mortgages. Brian Bethune is an economist with Global Insight. He says normally, when banks run low on short-term reserves, they have to borrow from each other.
If a bank does avail itself of those options, there can be a sense of maybe that bank has some problems in terms of funding itself. So what the Fed did is say, okay, in order to avoid that problem, we'll create this temporary auction facility so banks can borrow those funds anonymously.
Even after $260 billion in short-term low-interest loans, banks remain reluctant to lend. John Deary is with the Industry Trade Association, the Financial Services Forum. He says so far the Fed auctions are helping banks with their day-to-day operations, and soon he thinks the money will help them overcome their lending skittishness.
I think that the evidence is that it is working. It's just going to take time. You know, these are problems that aren't solved overnight.
The Fed reports plenty of demand for its low-interest loans. With $50 billion to auction, the central bank received bids for $90 billion. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of sideways, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not just wannabe home buyers who are keeping an anxious eye on the real estate market. Housing's an opportunity for a whole lot of buyers right now, including state pension funds. They cover health care and retirement benefits for millions of public employees across the country. They lost billions when subprimes hit and the market collapsed. Now they smell bargain and they are getting back into the game. Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
States like South Carolina and Pennsylvania think it's time to start real estate shopping. Maryland plans to double its real estate investments over the next couple years. John Greenberg is the investment strategist for Maryland's pension fund. He says it's time to buy.
It's always better to buy something that's in some distress. You can buy things at a discount.
Greenberg says real estate investment trusts, mortgage-backed debt, and international real estate investments will make up about 10% of Maryland's $37.5 billion fund. Greenberg says states can't afford to play it too safe right now.
We all have a return that we have to hit in order to pay our benefits. And right now, if bond yields are so low, we can't really hit those return targets. What a lot of states are doing is they're taking a lot of the money that would be in bonds and they're shifting it over to other asset classes. And one of those asset classes is real estate.
But while these are far from subprime investments, states need to take it slow, says Nicholas Ritsinas, director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard.
At this point in the market where prices are continuing to decline, you want to be careful. You don't overly sort of anticipate and get ahead of it.
But Ritsinas says there are clearly bargains to be had.
While we don't know, you know, what are the right prices for some of these assets, whether it be real estate or the mortgage-backed securities, right now the valuation has been discounted by what I call the fear factor.
Ritsinas says 2008 will likely be another rough year for the housing market, but he says when it comes, the recovery could happen fast. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The United Nations says more than 4 million Iraqis have been displaced because of the war. Just over 2 million are still inside the country. An equal number is spread across the rest of the Middle East. 750,000 or more are in Jordan. They're not gathered in a single refugee camp there. They're spread out into the local communities where they've had to find places to live and enough to eat and an education for their children. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from the Jordanian capital, Amman.
It's a Thursday evening. School was dismissed hours ago, but the lights are on in one classroom at the far end of a dingy hallway at this school in Marka near Amman. Outside the door is a pile of shoes. Inside, a dozen or so boys are sitting in a circle playing a math game.
The main purpose of this program is to allow these kids to go back to a sort of educational system.
Jawan Al-Husus works with QuestScope, a nonprofit that runs a program for dropouts in Jordan, which uses non-traditional teaching methods to help kids get a high school equivalency degree. These days, he's working hard to get Iraqis involved in the program, too. There are probably tens of thousands of Iraqi kids living in Jordan who should be in school, but aren't. Circumstances, including some government policies, mean that a lot of them have dropped out. For one thing, Iraqi refugees weren't even allowed to attend public schools in Jordan until this academic year. For another, Jordanian law forbids any student who misses 3 years of school from re-entering the system. So a kid like Ismail, who hasn't been enrolled since his family left Iraq 3 years ago, couldn't go back to school. even if he wanted to. He's one of the boys playing math games this evening.
I can't go to school because I have to support my family.
He works as a cashier in a school cafeteria. His brother, who's also in the class, sells flowers on the street. For them, basic survival is more pressing than education right now, and Al-Husus realizes it.
But when they will start to know that they will stay more than they thought before, then they will start to look for opportunities. One of these major opportunities is education.
Education's key not just for the kids, but for the whole society. Jason Erb works for Save the Children, an NGO involved with education issues.
The future education prospects are down to next to nothing, and of course that's going to have a huge impact on what they can do once they reach adulthood.
It'll have a huge impact on Jordan, too, if the Iraqis end up staying, because they'll be unskilled and hard to employ. If they do end up going home, it'll have a huge impact on Iraq, because much of Iraq's professional class, the doctors, lawyers, engineers, has fled the country. Their children are the ones who should be the professional class of the future, but now many are being denied an education.
And that's why a lot of organizations are looking at other ways to at least provide some sort of educational opportunity or some other sorts of skills to these kids.
Like at this community center in East Amman, where Iraqi students can take remedial classes in subjects like math, English, and Arabic, whether they're enrolled in local schools or not. The programs are free, and they're designed to be flexible to allow for students who have to work or care for younger siblings. But even minimal costs, such as car fare, can be enough to keep kids from attending. And none offers an obvious path to a university education, even for students who had been on that track in Iraq. Groups like Questscope are still trying to figure out how to change that. Al-Husus says until they do, these programs still offer obvious advantages.
The main benefit from this is not just to be educated, not just to know how to read and to write, not just to have life skills.
But to remind the students that they too can have a future, which is what Ismail says. He has to work every day, but at night he comes to study because he still wants to go to the university. In Marka, Jordan, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
We brought back a ton of pictures, stories, and videos from our special coverage of the Middle East earlier this month. They're all online through our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, an old-school kind of brainstorming.
I've gotten to the point where I kind of think the first thing we should do when it comes to problem-solving, don't tell my client at Microsoft this, but throw away all the computers.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average nudged down 0.1% today, 16 points to end the day at 12,532. The NASDAQ picked up 0.6%, 14 points, 2341. The S&P 500 inched up 0.2%, 2 points, closed at 1352, the S&P did. Rumors that Microsoft might sweeten its offer for Yahoo pumped the web giant shares up more than 4%. Bank of America was the big loser on the Dow. A downgrade from Merrill Lynch sent the Charlotte-based financial giant down 3.5%. A discovery of natural gas in Louisiana fueled a 3% rally in Chesapeake Energy. Goodrich Petroleum, which owns land in the same area, was energized by the news. Its stock picked up more than 16% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note ended the day at 3.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the
Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods and new home sales for February. The Consumer Federation of America discusses gasoline prices at the National Press Club. And Leonard Nimoy turned 77. He came out of retirement to board the USS Enterprise once again for Star Trek the film, due out on the big screen next year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Fresh from his behind-the-scenes role in orchestrating the bailout of Bear Stearns, Henry Paulson will take the podium for a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in the morning. Question is, what more can the Treasury Secretary possibly say that we haven't already heard? He'll surely talk about the credit squeeze in the housing market and what the White House is doing to turn them both around. Probably won't say too much about new regulations from Wall Street, and it's a safe bet the R-word's not going to pass his lips. Commentator and economist Susan Lee says we could do worse than a garden-variety recession.
No question, the economy is at a crossroad. So what if I give you a choice? We could have either a short, even steep recession, or a long bout of stagflation. That combination of stagnant growth and high inflation. Before you answer, oh, okay, stagflation, how bad could it be? Let me suggest exactly how bad it could be. The country had a decade of stagflation in the 1970s. Economic growth was lackluster, while inflation skyrocketed at double-digit rates, peaking at a little under 15%. Unemployment was also ruinously high, and real per capita income actually fell in three of the years of that decade. Not a pretty picture. Worse, the cure for that bout of stagflation was, as it always is, a nasty recession. When the Fed finally crunched down on money and credit to bring down inflation, the economy tanked. Between 1981 and 1982, unemployment peaked at over 10%, and the economy shrank about 3% in 16 months. Now consider a garden variety recession. Looking at recent history, the average recession lasts less than a year, unemployment averages 7%, and the economy registers modest declines of 1 to 1.5%. Unpleasant, sure, but not as unpleasant as stagflation. So you'd think the Fed would be trying to avoid stagflation. No, for the past 8 months, policy has aimed right at it. The Fed has been madly lowering interest rates six times since last September. Now, granted, the Fed hopes that low interest rates and acres of money will bail out the economy. But at the same time, it ignores powerful signs of inflation. Commodity prices like wheat are streaking out of sight. Oil and gold prices have hit record highs, and the dollar is too weak to maintain its parity with the Swiss franc. And so maybe it's time to offer two cheers for a recession.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. Your thoughts are always welcome, no matter where you live. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. There's a conference room here that I have to pass to get into the studios, and a lot of the time when I walk by, there's a PowerPoint presentation of some kind going on. We've all been there. The person doing the presenting puts up the slide and then reads it to you out loud. In his new book, Back of the Napkin, author and consultant Dan Rome says if we want better presentations and better ideas, too, the first thing we ought to do is get rid of all those PowerPoints. Dan, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here, Kai.
Napkins or PowerPoint, what's the difference?
Oh, my goodness. Well, napkins are a much more spontaneous way to be able to present ideas. And if you think about this, why are napkins interesting? Because when you take a napkin and you just start drawing on it and start imagining what an idea that's in your own mind looks like, all of a sudden you open up all kinds of channels in your own mind that if you're just working on a computer screen or just working with the shapes that are available, say in PowerPoint, do not happen. In fact, I don't want to go on too much of a mantra about this,
sorry,
but I've
ahead.
Gotten to the point where I kind of think the first thing we should do when it comes to problem solving, don't tell my client at Microsoft this, but throw away all the computers. Seriously, nothing beats just putting a pen on paper.
Yeah, but how about this? I'm, let's say, a client of yours, and I'm paying you rich consulting contracts like you consultants get, and you walk into a meeting with a piece of napkin. What am I going to think, right?
Yeah. Well, fantastic things are going to happen.
But that's because I know what I'm doing. I have done enough napkin sketching to where, and this is what the book is really about, a set of very basic tools and rules that anybody can use, regardless of artistic talent or artistic training, to begin to think about ideas in new ways simply by creating them on paper live.
Well, let me put you on the spot a little bit and obviously have you draw something on a napkin, right? Because this is just begging for one of those conversations. What I was going to do was have you give me your book pitch on a napkin. But I figured that was too easy because you've done it a million times. And obviously it was successful because we're sitting here talking about your book. Let me throw another one at you here as we wrap things up. Are you a public radio listener?
I am.
Okay. Get another piece of paper and imagine you represent Marketplace in the sales world. And it's your job to get this program onto public radio station. You have to go and convince the program director there that Marketplace is a program they ought to carry.
Okay.
Ready, go.
All right. I'm Marketplace. I'm over here. I'd say, here's the program director at Station X, who's not convinced that I have anything to sell them.
Right.
What I would bring along is I would say, let's make a map of the United States. Let's make a map of where the money is. The money's here, it's here, it's here, it's here, it's here. It's in all the major metropolitan areas.
Coasts and Chicago, he says on the map.
Exactly. Point is, the people who have the money, who are good radio listeners, probably people driving their cars, are located in these areas. And the people that listen to Marketplace are, number one, the people that have the money, the people that drive to work, and the people that listen to the radio. They're also, because they're the people who have the money, they're the people who buy products. So if in your market, you want to be able to reach the audiences that have the money and have the time to listen to the radio and are intelligent decision makers about what they buy, you want to carry Marketplace.
Boom. Done. I'd say you're hired.
Okay. Great.
Dan Rome, the book is called The Back of the Napkin, Solving Problems and Selling Ideas and Radio Programs, too, with pictures. Dan, thanks a lot for coming in.
Kai, my pleasure. Thank you.
Want to see what Dan's sales pitch for us looks like? Check our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, perhaps something to bear in mind as you make your summer travel plans. A federal appeals court in New York struck down that state's airline passenger bill of rights today. Remember the big snafu when passengers were stranded on planes for hours on end during a couple of bad storms last winter? Not enough food, no water, clogged toilets. You remember that, right? The Bill of Rights was supposed to fix that, but the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that however well-intentioned, only the federal government has the authority to pass that kind of regulation. Nevertheless, California is considering a version of its own. There has been talk in Congress, too, of a federal version. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 16 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq added 14 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 skated up 2 points. That is 0.2%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a video game that helps players face fears.
15 of them are scowling at you, and they're quite critical and rejecting. One of them is smiling warmly, and you just have to find the one smiling face over and over and over again.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.